Excuse me. Hey, boys. Yeah, you. Yeah. Got something to say? Share it with the whole class.
Welcome to the back of class, a guide to education from the kids at the back of the class. Thanks to those of you who are joining us for the first time and those of you who have decided to join us for more than the first time. Keep on following us. We can be found in the Apple Podcast Store by searching for Back of the Class. And we can also be reached by email at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com.
Yeah, check that.
Hey, you'll be happy to know that I checked the email.
Nice.
You'll be sad to know there's nothing in it. Additionally, we have a blog for the show that they can be found at thebackoftheclass.blogspot.com. Please feel free, give us your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. Each week, one of us, my friend Daniel and I, we get together and we talk about a topic of interest at least we talk about a topic. It may not be of interest, but it's a topic. It's a topic on education. We spend a few minutes talking about it, basically coming at it from the K-12 perspective and from the university perspective. As always, I'm going to introduce Daniel. He's a great friend of mine, and he is Aquaman in the pool.
Wow.
So
I don't talk to the fishes.
Yeah. Well, I'm basing that on your reputation rather than any firsthand
knowledge. Precedes me. Nice.
Yeah. I'm going to sign up for a mile race in May.
A mile swim?
Yeah, baby.
That's hardcore.
I did 1,200 today, and I haven't swam in 2 weeks, so I might be able to. As always, with me is my good friend Patrick, the gazelle, super mutter, going for his, supposedly going for a big 50 headband this year. So
I'm trying.
It's always a pleasure, man, you know, talking about topics.
Talking about an article. Topic of interest.
Used to be three of us for all of you who are our constant listeners, but we're down to two.
He was an anchor in both senses of the word.
We do miss you, Simon.
We do. He made one of us. We'll see if he is actually listening at all. Then I expect an email from him at our.
Oh, I got to be something. Sure.
Yeah. So anyway. So today we're talking about a topic that there's an article, and I don't think Daniel has had a chance to read this quite all the way through yet, but the article is, it's from edsurge.com, and it's, why is it so hard to teach K-12 educators how to personalize learning? And I'm interested in this because personalized learning is something that I try to do in my classrooms. And so I was kind of looking through this stuff, and I mainly brought this article in today to tear it up a little bit, because this guy who wrote this is maybe I should say this person who wrote it. I don't think they necessarily get it, or they didn't do much to convince me that they got it. So let me ask you, Daniel, what do you think when you hear the term personalized learning?
The 21st century.
Yeah, we're 20% into the 21st century.
Yeah. You know, it's a pretty popular buzzword. I mean, I think we're, you know, I think that is the, you know, we're trying to, I think the focus is on trying to do that. And I, you know, it's just a lot of people are talking about personalized learning, but you know, kind of the stuff he said, you know, things are often still very unpersonalized. And you know, we were talking about personalizing education when I was in the classroom, which has been a good 20 years. So
it's been a great 20 years for those students that didn't have you in the classroom.
All my kids are all adults now, probably thriving.
I wish I could track down the second graders I taught in 1995.
How old are they now?
They'd be in their 30s.
30s, yeah.
Yeah. Lord.
You know, so there's a lot of talk of personalizing instruction. You know, I think, you know, the interesting when we're in the, it's all, I always find it interesting when we are usually talking about personalizing learning. It is in as unpersonalized an environment as possible. You know, we don't really teach by doing, we teach by telling. So teachers don't have a lot of experience. And how do they do that in a classroom in an environment that, you know, is still focused on very kids taking minimum competency tests and passing at the end of the year? And, you know, so we don't really have personalized learning objectives at the end of the year. So,
yeah. Well, here's the interesting thing for me is that, let me just read to you the first paragraph of this article, and it might give you a sense of why I was so frustrated with it. So this author says, as a longtime music teacher and instructional technology coach, modeling has been key to my work for over a decade. The concept of gradual release of responsibility is second nature to me when working with students in grades K through 12. But in my new role teaching graduate students in an educational technology program, I am struggling to model so many of the practices I expect these teachers to use in their own classroom. Why is it so hard to teach K-12 educators how to promote student agency and to provide choices around content and pacing? Why is it so hard to teach educators how to personalize learning?
Because the problem is in our universities. Next article, everybody.
That's what, I'm not going to necessarily disagree with that. That's the thing. I struggled with this article for a while because I couldn't really put my finger on why it frustrated me. And I think I finally had a bit of a breakthrough when I realized that I don't want to be too hard on this person, though. That's the thing. It shows a lack of awareness of what you're trying to do when you make that kind of a blanket judgment, particularly since the examples that this person has made throughout the rest of the article demonstrate activities that are modeling those kinds of things. Let me give you an example. I don't think it's necessarily all that difficult to model this kind of behavior in a K-12, in a university setting. And that's how you should teach K-12 educators to do this kind of stuff, is by modeling it to them. If we end up teaching the students the same way we've always taught the students, then they're going to end up translating those practices into the classroom when they go out into the classroom and teach. And so sitting there and saying, oh, woe is me, it's so hard to teach educators how to personalize learning, misses the point entirely, because the agency is on you. Just do it. Don't complain about it. The same thing that this person said was so easy to do with K-12 students is no harder to do with university students. It's just, you got to do it. In many ways, it's actually easier to do with university students, because we don't have the same kind of standards-based curricular concerns that K-12 does.
Yeah, but we don't have teachers coming out of these programs prepared to, or do they get here in our environment, in the K-12 environment is just not set up for them. You know what I mean? It's just, I think it's all this cycle that people run into, you know? Like you say, when they get here, do we have environments that are set up for them to personalize instruction? I don't know. You know, does that make sense? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's always kind of come off, like, as you said, it always comes off to me as one of those buzzwords that, like, yes, we want to be the guide on the side and not the sage on the stage. And
but nobody's willing to take the risk to do it. There's a lot of risk.
Well, not only that, but like when I actually go out and talk with teachers about this stuff, and I tell them, all right, well, you know, how many of you have been told you need to be the guide on the side and not the sage on the stage? They all raise their hands. I say, all right, well, how many of you have been told how to do that? Like, who could show me an example of what that means? And all those hands go down really quickly.
Yeah.
So it's a failure at the university level to prepare them to do that effectively, but it's also a failure at the K-12 public school level to provide a context where that could even be possible in many cases.
Well, yeah, I mean, but we're really not working together on this problem either. I mean, not in a grand sense. I mean, I don't think K-12 institutions are necessarily working with universities to say, hey, what type of learning do we expect our pre-service teachers to come with? That's why I find it so ironic that a lot of times it's like this vicious circle in education where, you know, colleges are saying, hey, we're not getting high school students that are prepared for the college classroom. And then, you know, after 4 years, the K-12 districts are saying, hey, we're not getting workers that are prepared for the classroom. So, you know,
I think
we know this is a problem when we don't get together and fix it.
Well, then, I mean, that's an issue of incentives. What are the incentives to get together and fix it? Like, I can speak from the university level. Most academics who are in my position are not pressured to do service work, the kind of hard work and communicative work that would require us to get on the same page with the K-12 practices. What we're pressured to do is research. Mm-hmm. And all of our research is presented for other academics, not for practitioners. It's very rare that a journal is written or an article is written for the intended purpose of actually having a teacher in the classroom read the work and change practice. Yeah.
But for me, if I think back on me, what was the value add of my university education? One, I think I went to a good English program. I learned a lot of English content. I mean, I like English. Two, I got to work with a mentor that was an education reformer type. But I don't know what the value add was in terms of any of the education courses I took. So, I mean, what does it say about ed schools? I mean, can't we just get people that are content specific and know their content, and then we'll train them how to teach? If they're not coming prepared to teach in a personalized classroom, and that's what we need, why doesn't K-12 just pick it up and say, hey, you know, this is the type of learning we expect. You don't have to get whether we require this certification that universities give. It seems like it's this weird system that we require something that is of no value really, or of limited value other than outside of their primary content area of biology or nothing, because they're learning these methods courses that don't really have relevance when people are saying we need to personalize instruction or use digital tools. And they, you know, we're still having a very, you know, teachers aren't being taught how to, you know, like in this morning, making voice and choice. I think he talks about how we, you know, we tend to give kids this idea of voice and choice. And, you know, we have another buzzword that, you know, kids are still in this very structured environment that essentially allows them to create a very similar cookie cutter presentation by using a couple tools, but ultimately the end product is not different.
See, I would differ a bit with you in the, not necessarily in the fact that universities are dropping the ball a bit, but in where they're dropping the ball. Like you mentioned the idea of them learning, you know, unnecessary information in their methods classes. When in reality, I don't think that that's where universities are doing their kids a disservice.
And it would be where?
In the practical application. That's where I think that they're not doing very well. I mean, they're doing, we do a fair job with theoretical stuff, but we don't do a great job with the practical aspects of getting people into classrooms and having them be a practicing teacher while they're still under, the structures of learning the craft at the undergraduate level.
Well, they get here and then they fall into the same structures, right? That kids have to, like in K-12, we just can't get our head around the idea of let's hold people accountable at the end of the year. But, you know, what we do is we just build in these different milestones of every 6 or every 9 weeks that we're going to test and we're going to assess. And, you know, we're going to tell teachers that they're not meeting, you know, they're not meeting these end goals. But that is quite challenging in an environment where you have kids at all vastly different levels of reading performance. And if the idea is to personalize instruction for these kids, they might not hit the mark in 9 weeks.
Yeah.
So teachers aren't rewarded or incentivized in any way. Or even, you know, we tell teachers, hey, you know, feel free to innovate and experiment. But, you know, our community holds our principals and our superintendents accountable for, you know, closing the gap. Or we want to report every 9 weeks of where we are in closing the gap. And it's like kids are coming out and they're rote and they're all the same third grader. You know, you could have kids that are reading on a sixth grade level and kids that aren't reading yet.
I don't understand the like, you and I have both been in education a long time, but the majority of the time we've been in education, we've been under this umbrella of the No Child Left Behind accountability movement, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
I don't remember having a lot of experience teaching before that became the norm.
No, I mean, A Nation at Risk comes out in what, 85, 86?
Yeah, but I mean, the practical applications of like what that did to setting standards and, you know, the instruction and the rigid structure associated with classrooms came in the early 2000s, right?
Yeah.
And you and I, we had maybe, you know, 5 years of teaching under our belt before then.
Yeah, we had transitioned and we're already in graduate school at that point.
Yeah, which means I don't remember, all of this is to say, I don't remember what educational institutions were, what they looked like before the accountability movement. No. Maybe it was the Wild West. Maybe it would have been easier to do differentiated, personalized learning in that kind of a setting. But I think it's really difficult when we're trying to funnel everybody to the same standards to then say, but the way we're going to do it is we're going to let you choose your own pathway to get there. That doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just it's a problem of, you know, you have elected school boards that have certain expectations and certain community responsibilities. Those school boards are hiring our superintendents. So, I mean, we've got to look at the problem to say, what are all the variables standing in the way? We have, you know, curriculum that might, you know, we're still teaching kids reading, writing, math, and science other than critical thinking, communication, and collaboration. I mean, it's just like what end product? That's why whenever, especially as a technology guy now, I mean, if I'm going to put in a box, my question always is, well, what do we want our classrooms to look like? Mm. And a lot of times we're still starting with, hey, we have all this data, but, you know, what questions are we trying to answer? And what are we doing once we have that data? I mean, are we sticking with it? Are we sticking with any initiative, you know, longer than a 5-year period, or are teachers just kind of saying, hey, you know, this one will blow over just like the next. So it's difficult to change a system without continuity of vision and mission. And when you have, you know, it would just be nice to have, if school boards were here for like 10 years or something, or, you know, but, you know, this possibility that you could have a new school board every 4 years and a new strategic plan and a new mission, a new vision. And, you know, the only people that aren't really going anywhere are our teachers.
Yeah, well, I mean, that doesn't even take into account all the upheaval at the school-based administration, the kind of the day-to-day leadership. And there is a certain level of turnover in instructional staff. But here's the thing that really frustrates me. I think even I was talking about this earlier, like the epiphany that I had about this article. I think the thing that really frustrates me most is that I get this sense that academics will come out and we'll talk about all these great ideas about, you know, the guide on the side and the sage on the stage, or personalized learning, or, you know, what was it that he said in here? Choice and voice.
Choice and voice.
All of those sound to me like great theoretical constructs, but when confronted with the realities of the classroom, all that kind of goes out the window. And it's entirely like the system is not set up to make those things possible. It's designed for a very specific purpose. And the times when those things happen, they happen in spite of the system, not because of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, look at a first year teacher. So a first year teacher goes into the classroom. Here's your 30 kids for period one, you know, have at it. So, I mean, what do those new student teachers do? Well, they go gravitate towards the 20-year vet who, or anybody who agrees to help them out. And, you know, they say, well, basically here's a lesson for you, or do this or do that. So, I mean, we just don't really even have a good support structure for new teachers. I'm speaking in generalities, but, you know, how do we help a new teacher be successful? Or do we give them all the most challenging kids that have all failed algebra? You know, I mean, how are we supporting them in this idea of walking a path? You know, I mean, we got new teachers who have, let's say they've been through this really innovative technology training program or this really innovative methods class. And, well, you know, it's almost like they need more mentorship and working with somebody at least to get started.
See, but that's where I think the universities are doing their pre-service teachers even a bigger disservice than that, because this is the location where that actually could be possible, where we could nurture them. We could do more than just, here, you're going to go in and you're going to do a six-week student teaching, and that's going to be your practice, you know, and you're going to observe for 2 weeks, you're going to teach for 2 weeks, and then you're going to go, like, remove yourself from the situation for 2 weeks.
Exactly.
That does not, like, there's no wonder that the teachers who come into the setting, who have gone through that as their practical experience, are treading water at best for the first couple of years.
Oh, yeah. And by then, you know, it's like you're, then you become set in your practice.
Yeah. And not, or you just,
or you get a new administrator.
Or you decide teaching is not for you.
That's right. And you leave.
And start a wedding cake business or something, you know? Yeah. I don't know what you do. But, I mean, it seems like we're wasting human capital by not doing a better job of transitioning people into the practical aspects of teaching. I mean, we give them the theoretical stuff. And, for instance, our experience where we did the prime internship, where we taught for a full year, and we had the support structures in place so that it wasn't just, that's our job.
Yeah.
To do it, you know, we had
to observe a lot.
Yeah, we had to observe. We were doing things like rotating through grade levels and content areas to free up planning time. There was a lot of support in that. And I feel like I was better prepared to be a classroom teacher after that, obviously, than I would have been if I just observed for a few weeks, taught for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, I slowly transitioned out of the classroom.
My question is, I just don't understand why it's so difficult to do it, like you said earlier.
I think it's institutional inertia. It's the way it's been done. But I don't think there's any reason that it's the way it has to do. It's interesting to me to think back on Prime and find, and reflecting back on it, the reason that Prime kind of failed and imploded was not because of problems at the K-12 level. It was problems at the university level. That's what imploded Prime.
Yes, 100%. But ultimately, it imploded Prime, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But, I mean, that's because the system at the university level is just as hidebound as a K-12 institution is. It's just a different process. It has its own institutional inertia, and anything that combats against that, people complain. They find reasons to not be involved. They find reasons for fault. But anyway, you know.
Seems like we've had this discussion before.
Yeah. Well, then let's finish this on a high note. How do we solve it? Like, what would you suggest in 2 minutes? Like, if you had one,
we apply for a $300,000 North Carolina Digital Learning Initiative grant.
See, I
have a new professional development model and a new professional development model that, you know, provides teachers the time to experiment, a working mentor, and a real solid collaboration with between a school district and a university setting. I mean, it's the exact proposal that we're pitching right now.
See, the reason I like that proposal is because it more closely aligns what pre-service teachers are, the kind of training that pre-service teachers are getting with what they'll be expected to do in high quality in-service training.
Yeah. And it's just like Prime in that, you know, if we would have been with the Prime project, you know, when we got hired at Norfolk, we were all automatically promoted to the second year of teaching. You know, here, if we have pre-service teachers that are getting the same digital training and earning the same micro badges, well, you know, they will come in on project advanced compensation structure of already having earned these things. Yeah. You know, it's a win-win for the district because the district is going to know, hey, this is the model of teacher training that we know and understand what people are going through. The student teachers have a whole new perspective of what it means to work in a digital one-to-one learning environment or whatever the case may be. We have teachers here that they can then count on for support. We're setting up the mentorship program with our instructional technology facilitators. You know, we're working with faculty to incentivize them to experiment with new teaching methods. And we're going around the state to say, hey, we have a model that functionally might change the way that Your teachers are working to deliver instruction, providing them with the time to personalize. So, I mean, we're doing exactly what we say needs to be done. And, you know, I hope people recognize that when they read this proposal.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree. I think that the alignment between this is, in essence, for me, this is kind of like a first step in aligning pre-service training with in-service action and practice. But I think more of that needs to be done. I think, quite honestly, if I had a magic wand and I could just wave it and make things happen, I would drastically change the amount of time that pre-service students are expected to be in the classroom working with students. Like, that would be a much bigger component, you know, a year long, year and a half long, almost like a surgical residency, mm-hmm. where the students are out there actually teaching and getting some of the content from here, getting some strategies, interacting with the instructional staff, looking at the research that we're doing and trying to transition it into the school districts. But they would have much more practical experience actually dealing with students in their content area.
You're right.
All right. Well, anyway, we're almost at 30 minutes. Imagine that. So
I was.
Even when we're talking about a topic of not so much interest.
Yeah. I think we it kind of ties into the work we're doing right now. I mean, at least we're working the work.
So well, yeah. I mean, you and I are right now at that level of our professions where we're senior enough where we can actually make decisions. Mm-hmm. And try to implement some of the things that we'd like to see while still being young enough not to be jaded by everything. And stuck in our kind of institutional mindset.
Yeah, right. You're right.
All right. Well, with that, why don't we switch over to our Mudder Minute?
Mudder Minute.
I'd like to hear about your swimming, this mile-long thing that you want to
say. Yeah, man. So I'm trying to get back into it, you know. The foot's been hurting a little bit, so I'm getting back in the pool. I swam a good 1,100 today. I probably could have went a little longer, but I've been out for a couple weeks. So,
you do breath.
So, yeah, I'm going to go for a mile swim down at Lake Jordan. And, this will be my first open – I'm really essentially not open water, but, I mean, I've never done anything like this, so.
How do you measure off a mile?
How do they measure off a mile in the pool, in the lake?
Yeah,
I don't know how they do it.
No, I thought you were just going out and doing like a swim. That's what I thought you were doing.
No, it's race day, man.
When is that?
May 15th. Jordan Lake.
A mile. I think I could doggy paddle.
It's amazing. But I mean, I've never done and I've never swam that far. I've swam that far, but not in water over my head. So I've heard it's actually interesting. It's a different head turn too, because you know, you don't have you can't really see. So you don't have ropes on either side.
You don't have those lines on the bottom of the pool.
That's right. So, you know, you kind of got a different head turn to make sure you're on course. And I don't know. I heard it's a little bit intimidating with all the people there and the kicking and the,
Lord.
I don't know.
I don't know if I could, I don't think I would appreciate getting kicked in the head.
I'm going to wait till people go out. I'm not trying to win. Just trying to finish.
That's horrible.
So hopefully that'll get me back into it, man.
Well, I guess if you're if your foot is on fire every time you touch something, then it's all right to be in water. Put that thing out.
I mean, it's just the weirdest feeling. I'm gonna have to go in and have it looked at. There's no doubt about it. Going away with stretching. So
I'll tell you, this past weekend at that other race, man, that was a tough course.
Yeah. You got 5 laps though.
Yeah, it was much tougher than Myrtle Beach was. A lot of up and down mountain hills in Maryland.
But it was fun?
Yeah, it was actually a lot more challenging, not only because it was up and down, but it was also like it had the same obstacles.
Yeah.
But they were longer. So like they would have a bucket carry that you actually had like a legitimate walk. Whereas the bucket carry in Myrtle Beach was like, walk 15 steps and bring your bucket back. They did the same with a sandbag carry. They did the same with a bunch of other things. And they had tire flips uphill Right? You had to flip the tire twice uphill and then twice downhill.
Nice. So was this in Maryland?
Yeah, in Maryland. They had a tire pull, like the tire, like big tractor tire on a rope that you had to pull towards you to a,
like all the Spartan things you miss and remember.
Yeah, but it was like uphill. So you're pulling this tractor tire uphill. So it was a lot more challenging.
Nice. Did Vanya make it to the race?
Oh, of course not. Why would she?
She was traveling with you, right?
Yeah. She was traveling with me to go to see her best friend, not to go to the race. Boy, has no interest in that.
When are you buying your season pass?
I'm soon. The first race is in Philly in like end of May.
Wow.
There's a Bone Frog up in Virginia Beach.
I do the Bone Frog, man. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would do the full, like the unlimited laps one is like $124.
Yeah.
But you can go to the sprint for $29.
Yeah.
So.
I'm betting you can go to the sprint and just see if you like it at least.
Yeah. I mean, it's down the street from my house, so.
Got to do it.
Yeah. It's a cheap option. You got, if you wanted to come up and do it.
Yeah, I might come up and spend the weekend.
Yeah.
See the folks.
All right. Well, with that, I'm going to draw this to a close.
It's always a pleasure, man.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. Sorry I had low energy today. I've, you know,
sleeping
in a hotel for almost 2 weeks, and I'm ready for my bed.
I get it. Right. Until next week, then.
All right, man. Hey, Simon. We love you, buddy.
Love you.